Hello and welcome to edition 338, the best of the Monocle Weekly in 2015 on Monocle 24, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show later, we'll be looking back across the year and remembering a few of our favourite interviews, including
Hasse Pearson, the Swedish photographer who shot the glory days of one of New York's most decadent nightclubs, Studio 54.
I must say, the temptations at the place was enormous. I'm glad I had a camera to hold on to.
We'll also look back to March, when we made a little space for a real-life astronaut here in Studio One with James F. Reilly.
So I just kind of kicked back in my suit and looked past the tail of Atlantis, and there was the Earth just floating by. And I'll never forget that view.
And we'll hear from indie rock royalty Thurston Moore, who swung by Midori House back in April.
I think as soon as things went into the digital realm, where the physical was kind of not so much available anymore, there's a bit of a passion that kind of disappeared.
Plus, there'll be a brush with the anarchic artistry of Miriam Elia. We'll turn the pages back to our chat with Garth Riss-Kohlberg, author of potential future literary classic, and polish up some old footwear faves with sneakerhead Jeff Staple as we look back at the best of 2015 here on the Monocle Weekly, right here on Monocle 24.
So how's the last year been for you, Rob?
I think it's beautiful. I like all the years that have a five in.
Do you?
Well, I'm a snake, and it looks a little bit like a snake, doesn't it? The number five.
Do you know what I am?
More so than any.
Do you know what I am?
I can't. I'm just trying to say, it looks like a horse from here.
No, tiger.
What? Tiger. Are you? That's a tabby, isn't it? That's a.
No, that's a dog. What does the dog do?
What does a tiger make?
No, I am the tiger, because when we did the forecast, which is currently out, with a monkey on it,
yeah,
many people were inspired to see what kind of animal they were.
Yeah, and you were sort of, I'm a fire snake, which is a particularly potent and pretty dangerous sounding snake. Are you a certain sort of tiger?
Cuddly. Cuddly, very cuddly. Because someone was the earth snake, I think that was Josh.
Yeah, he's an earth snake.
Which we wonder whether it was a bit like a worm, but we won't go there.
Yeah, an earth snake.
Well, a lot of things in the show. We've had a busy year.
It's been a hugely busy year. I expect Tom Hall, who produces the show, who's kind of gone through the archive of 2015, has had quite a difficult time.
That's water, by the way. I'm not pouring a glass of wine. Well,
we recorded this whole show in the gents at Midori House.
I'm rehydrating after Christmas Day. It's kind of necessary. Well, I guess so, because we're free of any of the kind of the news cats today.
Yeah.
So we should start. Let's see what we've got then, Rob.
Should we kick off?
Yes.
Let's kick off. The festive season is truly upon us, Andrew. What better way to kick off the Monocle Weekly's best bits than with a party? We're off to Studio 54, the nightclub that was the epitome of New York cool during the heady days of disco from 1977 to 81. There are few night spots more legendary or shrouded in myth and tall stories. But one man who was definitely there, and he's got the pictures to prove it, was Swedish photographer Hasse Persson.
Hasse spent years at Studio 54. I think he kind of occasionally went home, capturing its magic in photographic form. And back in February, he had just put them in a book, Studio 54. Robert and I caught up with him at his home in Sweden while he was on the line to relive some of the good times.
I'm basically a photojournalist, and I was covering world events, wars, and Oscar nominations and all that stuff. So this was an assignment that I gave myself. I was going to have a big exhibition in Stockholm, and I wanted to do something special. This goes back to 1979. And so I was focused on what I was doing, and I must say, the temptations at the place was enormous. I'm glad I had a camera to hold on to.
Yeah, it's everyone needed something or someone to hold on to. And it's a beautiful book, and it is very diverse, and it gives a kind of very, I guess it gives a very true story of the diversity of the sorts of people that made up the crowd at Studio 54. I wondered how it worked practically, whether you had an understanding with the doorman. It was notoriously difficult place to get into, especially back in its heyday in the late 70s there. Did you always manage to get in? What was your secret?
Well, Steve Rubell, who owned the place, and he was the dictator of the place, he gave me free access to take pictures in there. I think he had a secret dream that somebody would record the place for the future, and that somebody was probably me. I don't know if there were any other photographers that could go in and out at their own wish. So I was allowed to bring in my camera. I was also allowed to get in. I didn't have to stand in line, and I never paid an entrance fee or anything. So I just walked freely in the place, and I documented what I felt like. I wanted to get the spirit of the place. I was not a paparazzi photographer. Some, you know, there were some famous Ron Galella type of guy that crushed places and took pictures. I was just the opposite. I just wanted to record mainly unknown people. I didn't want to have too many famous faces, because that puts a time limits on the photograph. So I wanted to photograph the spirit of the place, and Steve Rebell apparently liked it.
So what's also interesting is, you know, it's quite hard to understand why this club and this moment has become so celebrated in pop history, in contemporary, you know, history of their time. But I wonder if it's because when we look at your pictures and look back, you know, here are kind of celebrities, you know, the likes of Calvin Klein and Liza Minnelli, Brooke Shields. And we know that after these pictures were taken, the events that would unfold in their lives, often not the the happiest of events. And we also know that this is a period pre-AIDS. There's a wonderful innocence to these pictures. Do you think that perhaps, you know, your photos are even more powerful because of the events that followed?
Yes, I think when you use the name innocent, that's what I feel also. Even though, you know, people made love up on the balconies, and there were lovemaking in the men's room and ladies' room, and actually quite frequently. But it was in a way innocent also, you know. And someone has said that Studio 54 existed between after the pill, before AIDS, and while you still thought cocaine was a health product. So it was an unbelievable time. And of course, AIDS closed down New York City, you know, in 81 or something like that. And then this party was over. And I think probably one of the reasons why it has become so famous is that it actually only lasted for about 1,000 nights, which is a short time. And all those nights were magical events. I mean, I could go there on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and it was like magic every night. And Steve Rebell was like a magician to put together this group that made the magic. And he had this idea about the tossed salad. You know, he told me once that he wanted to have about 20% should be gay, because women love to see men dancing. And he wanted that 5-10% should be lesbians or transvestites, because the male audience basically thought it was very exciting to see women kissing. And then it should be famous and rich people from the United States. But also, he wanted to mix in street kids from Harlem and the Bronx, because of Calvin Klein or Halston. They wanted to see what's the next ideas in street fashion. And then Steve Rebell wanted to have people from South America, particularly Brazilians. They were good at dancing. And then he wanted Eurotrash. Eurotrash was English people, you know, redhead people from England that had a funny dialect. And also Scandinavians, you know, that hardly spoke any good English at all. And then, you know, princes and princesses from south of Europe. So there was a mixture, and he managed to get that mix almost every night. So it was a magic place, and people, when they walked home in the morning, they had a happy smile on their faces.
That was the Swedish photographer Hasse Persson back there in February of this year, and his images are available in the book Studio 54. You're listening to the best of the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. Back in March, I missed a real humdinger of an episode, didn't I? With not only the talents of John Ronson, but also you got to meet a real-life space traveller, Andrew.
I certainly did. Astronaut James F. Riley was on the show to talk about a life lived among the stars. And he joined myself and Tom Edwards, who got a little bit excited, I must say, to tell us all about it.
And so one of the things that I did as an instructor when we had folks that were coming in to do the spacewalk training for the very first time is before we ever even got into the suit, I would give them a little challenge, and I thought you guys might be able to try this one out. So
I'd like to think I'm up for a challenge.
Okay.
Let's give it a go.
Okay, so here's a glove for each of you. Okay. So obviously one hand versus the other. Are either of you right-handed or both?
I'm right-handed.
Oh, so both are right-handed. Okay.
It's okay. We're going to do it. One of us need to put it on the left hand, really.
Actually, that's fine. This will be a challenge. We'll see who's better at this.
Okay.
All right, so, and what I'm going to do is, I've got coins here.
I wonder what those coins are for. I thought you were going to tip us at the end. Well, that's a nice guess.
Okay, so what I want you to do is just pick the coin up with the gloved hand. You can't use the other hand at all.
Okay.
Just pick up the coin with your gloved hand. And you can pick any of the three that I've got here. There's a 10p coin and a penny and a 1 pound coin.
Okay, so fine.
You can go for the thick one if you want, if you think you're
that was good. That was my immediate instinct, my competitive drive. And you go first, Andrew.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Confounded thing. This is less the same. We've put the coins on a piece of wood now, which
I managed with the chunky 1 pound coin. I just about managed. Yeah.
Okay. So let me give you the 10p here.
Okay, let's try that.
Let's try that one.
Be careful! This gentleman would have your money in his pocket in no time.
Yeah, I noticed the 1p coin disappearing.
Okay, it is almost impossible to pick these things up.
Okay, I'm defeated
mitten.
By that. I was going to try rolling it to the side and easing.
And we must point out these are not space gloves. These are
just regular old gloves.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now right here, do that same thing, but put your finger on the top of the coin, and put your thumb right there. Now just slide in.
Yes. So if we slide it off the piece of wood using an edge. And this is the technique you have to use when you're in space, I presume.
Actually, the only lesson there is really you have to think about doing things differently.
Okay.
Right? There's the usual way we do almost everything, and that is, just pick it up, right? Because that's what I asked you to do. But when you actually have to do it, you'll find that doing it the way we normally do it here on the ground is oftentimes impossible. That's the real lesson there.
The first time you're in space and you go out of the space station to do a spacewalk, an element of fear, an element of caution, because if it was me, I think I would be petrified.
Actually, the thing that was sort of amazing, and I'll actually start from the launch, because I expected to be quite nervous, actually, on the first one. You'd think that 3.5 million pounds of high explosive that you're strapped to is going to be something that focuses your attention and might get you a little nervous, but it turns out that on the day of launch for STS-89 on my first one, the night before, we actually go out to the pad, just the crew, just ourselves, and it's our opportunity to just kind of look up at this vehicle and think about what we're doing. And I was doing the same thing that I used to do with submersibles, and then I'd look at it and, well, what could happen? And you walk through and catalog all the risks. And basically, 90% of the things there are things that we're trained to respond to and can correct it. And then there's that last bit, and about 10% of the things that could possibly go wrong that you just don't have anything you can do about, and it's just a bad day. So I was sitting there thinking about that, and a young man came over, and he was part of a team that looked for ice on the outside of the vehicle before we launched, and he came over and said, we want to just let you know that you're going to have a 100% safe bird tomorrow. We're going to make sure of it. And I was just floored by that. And then so the next day I was thinking about him and realized he's really speaking for literally the hundreds of folks there at NASA that were working on the program to make sure it was as safe as it could possibly be. And then that became much easier to accept all those other risks that were left. And when I went out, I was actually not nervous at all. And the spacewalk has to be, by the time we get there, we've practiced so much on the spacewalks that we're thinking about all the details. And that's what I was thinking before I went out on my first one. And so I'm thinking about, here's what we're going to do. This is what I'm going to do first. I don't want to get behind here because if I am, it's going to impact here. And we literally had an 8.5 hour spacewalk down to 5 minute blocks. And we knew exactly where things were going to be and where each of us, the two of us that were going outside to do the spacewalks, where we were going to be, where the arm was going to be and all of these things. And so I'm thinking about that, thinking of all the things that could go wrong. What would we do about it? And that type of thing. And so I was thinking of the details. I imagine it's like being up for a championship match, and you're thinking about every possible thing, what your opponent, and our opponent, of course, was the environment, what's happening, what's going to happen, and thinking about all that stuff. And as I was doing that, the one thing that I was completely focused on was not failing. I just didn't want to fail. So I didn't want to start out behind. That would probably be the only thing I would say that I'm afraid of is failure, and that's probably fairly characteristic. Well, my wife, of course, but she's not here, thank goodness. So that was what I was thinking of. And then Yuri Usachev, who's the commander of the station, came over, gave me a safety brief. And I'm like, yeah, I got it. And then he goes, here's what I really want to tell you, though. And that is, you know, every hour you need to take 10 seconds, just look around, because this is this remarkable environment.
Well, I was going to ask you about this, because a lot of your predecessors have said, oh, the one thing I wish I'd done is just taken a look and you know, looked at Earth from space, this sort of thing. It's great that he gave you that advice. Had you been were you mindful of that already, or did it take that moment?
That was the best advice I've ever gotten, because at the end of an hour, I was on the end of the arm. Janet, who was driving the arm for me, had picked me up out of the payload bay, and we were moving to another position. And at that moment, I actually had 10 seconds, so I just kind of kicked back in my suit and looked past the tail of Atlantis, and there was the Earth just floating by. And I'll never forget that view, because what you can see with your eye is so much more than what you can see with any imaging system. It's incredible.
Astronaut James F. Reilly there, talking to Andrew and Tom Edwards about some of the do's and don'ts of space travel. What is it like? Pack a toothbrush, but not a... Yeah, and no talcum powder.
He was a kind of very nice, kind of serene gentleman. I could see him floating around up there.
You've got a picture of him on your desk, haven't you?
I've got a very picture of him in my desk. And I'm not joking, Tom Edwards was like a school kid meeting his hero. He was like so excited. And it's the only time we've ever come out of the studio and said, please, please, can I have a picture? Please, please.
Nice.
And he did.
It's good news.
Yeah.
All right, you are tuned in to the Best of the Monocle Weekly 2015 with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck. Up next, Sonic Youth's Thurston Moore.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
In April, we had a visit here at Midori House from rock music royalty. Thurston Moore is a musician who, through his 30-plus years with art rock act Sonic Youth, became a music icon, as well as enjoying a fruitful solo career encompassing any number of unusual and avant-garde projects.
In April, he dropped by Studio One to discuss the latest of those, a piece composed in conjunction with the London Sinfonietta Orchestra, plus visual and sound artist Christian Marclay, and performed at London's White Cube Gallery. The recording was pressed directly to vinyl at the event, produced in conjunction with London's Vinyl Factory. Thurston spoke about that recording and his many others to Monocle's Tom Hall.
Yeah, at one point, that's all we had were records. And I think as soon as things went into the digital realm where the physical was kind of not so much available anymore, there's a bit of a passion that kind of disappeared. The most important thing for me for music and art is like something that I first see and then I touch and then I smell, you know, like listening to a record, I always say is sort of kind of like the last thing I'm kind of interested in, because I sort of know what that's going to sound like, you know. And
yeah,
I mean, you know, you're going to hear it. You can hear it in any kind of format or any kind of realm. But I mean, the idea, all the other senses become involved and it becomes much more of a, you know, this kind of relationship that you don't have with digital music at all. And digital music is just numerical information anyway.
Yeah.
So your brain sort of hears it once and it processes it once and it doesn't need to process it again because it knows everything it's heard because it's numerical. Whereas I think listening to a record, it's in an analog realm and it's a bit more, you hear something new every time because it's slightly changes and your brain kind of enjoys that, I think. I mean, the pleasure of mystery, it gets kind of excited.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people like records.
You have done so much sort of one-off projects and unusual projects apart from, you know, things that everyone will know, like Sonic Youth and things like that. I mean, is there a considerable chunk of that you just don't even own? Are you still trying to track those down?
There might be a couple of things I don't have. You know, lately I've been sort of going online and eBay and looking for Sonic Youth appearances in magazines from different parts of the world, be it Czechoslovakia or Taiwan or something like that.
Okay.
They do exist. I do try to archive my own work, but I'm not too fastidious about it. But, you know, I'm generally more interested in other people's work than my own.
I really like that Dim Stars album you did with like Richard Hell and people like that. I mean, I know that's not like super obscure, but like, it's kind of, I remember, well, when I was still buying CDs, like it was kind of like you still had to pay quite a lot, like on eBay to get hold of one because they seem quite scarce. I mean, do you ever kind of think of revisiting any of those older bands? I mean, I'm sure.
Well, Dimstar.
I'm sure people would love to see you and Richard Hell on a stage.
Well, amazing. Richard Hell, he's a friend, and he actually came to London last year. He was doing something in Paris, and he wrote to me, said he wanted to come to London and just sort of hang out. And I said, well, that's great. Why don't we do a reading? You know, people would love to see you read from your book, or read your poetry, or just do a Q&A, and maybe we can set something up at, you know, Rough Trade East, or, you know, or somewhere in Stoke Newington, like, you know, at the town hall. Or, and he's like, no, I don't want to do anything public. I just want to be there, and I want to see some old friends, and I want to go have a proper English breakfast, and I want to, you know, like, and he just wanted to do these things that, like, he hadn't been there in a number of years. And I was like, oh, I know some people who'd really like to see you, you know, like, he goes, no, I don't want to see anybody. So he just sort of stayed in my flat.
You're now a London resident. You have been for quite a long time, a couple of years, as far as I know, or more. It might be a bit of a funny thing to say. I think people associate you and your music so strongly with New York. I think people find it really special when they see you around because it's kind of like, there's the New York guy. Like, what? Like people still can't get used to it a little bit.
Well, we always had London guys in New York.
Yeah,
you know, okay. And that was always cool.
Yeah.
I kind of lived in New York since late 76, and I was like 19 years old. And, you know, in the 90s, I split my time between New York and 3 hours north of that in Western Massachusetts, where our daughter was being raised. But I never really had this relocation, like any kind of radical relocation. And so to actually move here to London in my 50s, it was a kind of a big deal. And it still is a big deal. It still feels very strange. I kind of like the idea of sort of being alien, even though it's the same language, you know, because I had the ideas of like, oh, I live in Lisbon, you know, which is beautiful and inexpensive. And I like the scene there of people that do music and art in Lisbon. And, you know, or I live in Copenhagen, you know, where it has a great aesthetic that I really like. But I really, like, have been falling in love with London. I've come here since the 80s, and I've never really knew too much about it except for, you know, which record stores to go to or whatever, you what venue you would play at and what was nearby. But to try to figure out the geography of London because of its history is so old, it's become like a real sort of personal research into like how it reveals itself to me.
Your music, I mean, it always to me seems to be about tapping into something obviously creative, but like very natural sort of feeling almost. Would you ever be, or have you ever, I mean, you've done so many projects, would you ever be kind of interested in kind of taking one of these stories and kind of spreading it across maybe a concept album? I mean, is that a dirty word to you? I mean, no. is that something you'd be interested in? Like, you know, something very linear and sort of bound by a brief. Like, are you interested in sort of these concepts to work to?
You know, in music, I'm more interested primarily in what the music is as an abstract energy. And when I bring lyrics in, I'm more interested in the playfulness of language and as far as it alluding to any kind of situations, be it like something like a song like Detonation or whatever. You know, I don't like it to be too literal. I'm not interested in the literal in music so much. I like storytelling music, you know, certainly in like British folk music, there's this great legacy of storytelling that I find really wonderful. But I don't find that it's something that I'm too interested in doing. I like writing, you know, and I teach a writing course every summer at this writing workshop in Boulder, Colorado at a school called the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, which was founded by Allen Ginsberg in 1974 and Ann Waldman. And I think in writing, I find I can go more in that place just, you know, without it being something that's any kind of allegiance to music. But I mean, certainly writing can be musical. And that's, I think, my interest in poetry is because it's a very sort of, essentially, it's a musical writing. But I'm kind of interested in doing more essaying, and I've been working on that more lately. And I have published quite a bit of work, but it's usually very just small imprint stuff on my own imprint, which is called Ecstatic Peace Library.
I believe in Richard Hell's recent book, he was telling a story of, a poetry fanzine he made where someone ate paper and then turned it into excrement, and then they made it into like a papier sort of page in the book, which is one way to do it, I guess.
Yeah, that's,
that's real DIY, I think.
That is very DIY.
Well, that was Thurston Moore speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall back in April of this year. In August, Rob and I had a masterclass in street style from Jeff Staple, the New York mind behind the eponymously named Staple Design and Creative Studio, as well as the owner of Lower East Side boutique Reed Space. Jeff was on the show to talk about footwear, sneakers specifically, or trainers to our European listeners.
Jeff's cool grey take on the Nike Dunk Low Pro SB with its instantly recognisable pigeon logo caused a near riot for sneakerheads when they were first unleashed on the streets back in 2005. And when we spoke to him, the shoes had just been put in the Brooklyn Museum. Jeff had also been curating an auction in which a few more box fresh classics went under the hammer. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to tell us.
You know, sneakers were always made for performing on court and for athletes. I think what really pushed it out of that category was hip hop. I think before that, like with rock stars or punk stars, they weren't really rocking sneakers, or it wasn't really about their sort of fashion style. When hip-hop artists came about and people looked up to them musically, they would then look at what they were wearing. And hip-hop stars were wearing sneakers and trainers in all different weird ways, without laces, oversized, tongues sticking out of their pant legs, you know. So they were really redefining how sneakers were to be worn. And I think that was the first step, but it still wasn't quite the place where it is now, where it becomes covetable. I think the next thing that came was in the 90s, when athletes, particularly... Well, not particularly, but Michael Jordan is obviously the first one and the most notable one. But other ones, too, like Andre Agassi and Bo Jackson. These athletes, half because of their actual skill, but the other half because of the incredible marketing of the brands that supported them, really elevated them to like this godlike deity status, you know? And that's where kids just, I mean, between their favorite rapper and then, you know, Bo Jackson or Michael Jordan, like, you can't even fault the kid for coveting the thing that these guys have on their feet anymore. So that's where it really broke the mold, I feel.
And Jeff, are the ones that are most valuable, is that simply based on scarcity? Is it these kind of, I know in the collection there's, you know, there's a Chanel Reebok, for example. Is it just the rare examples that really people have in collections?
It's interesting. To be collectible, yes, it should be, and 9 times out of 10 it is rare. But the equation doesn't work the other way. So a sneaker company can't just say, we've made 12 of these, and then all of a sudden they become collectible and rare and covetable. It's not as easy as that. There has to be something else involved that escalates it a little bit.
And is that endorsement? Is that the endorsement of I mean, Kanye West, for example? I know he's designed some of the sneakers in this exhibition, for example. But is it the endorsement of a star, sporting or hip hop or otherwise, or is it something to do with the kind of brand DNA and kind of wanting the next thing that comes out of, for example, Nike?
Most of the times, it is. I like to call it collaboration versus endorsement. I don't think Kanye would like to call it endorsement either, because endorsement sort of implies like the Chuck Taylor, like, you know, Chuck Taylor was a person that was endorsed by Converse. So collaboration is more so, because when you collaborate, you know, the other person actually has a say in what the final outcome of the product looks like. Endorsements, typically, we've made this shoe, put it on your feet, and we'll give you a check. So that there's not.
So that
really
was the olden days, you know, that was the olden days, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And it still happens today, but those shoes, you know, like a generic everyday basketball player X on X team gets a shoe deal, but his shoe is not covetable. I think when you take someone that's respected for their aesthetic and their design sense, and then you collaborate them with a brand that is known for their production skill or technical ability, you can sort of start to create this magic in a bottle. But I call it magic because if you really study this stuff and you look at all the blogs and the magazines that cover this, it's really only 10% of what's made really, really sticks. The other 90 just ends up on, you know, page 15 of a blog and no one ever talks about it again.
And Jeff, you know, what's strange about this, you know, I guess for outsiders, is the very nature of, you know, sneakers is that they are ubiquitous. They are democratic in some sense. They're not hugely expensive when they first come out. So you go to your, you know, your shoe shop of choice or your sports store of choice, and the kind of everything's there. And when you get on the subway, you're just as likely to see, you know, an 80-year-old wearing sneakers as an 8-year-old. But what makes that culture around it still, you know, so valued? Because, you know, there's still shoes that come out. You know, I look around our office and a shoe will come out and you'll suddenly notice the cooler group in the office have all got the same shoe within a matter of weeks. It's funny how they still have this cultural currency despite being so ubiquitous.
Yeah, that's really the beautiful thing about shoes to me is, you mentioned it before, A, the accessibility of it. You know, so, you know, anywhere between $100 and $300, anyone can walk into a store and pick a pair of shoes. The first problem is you've got a wall of shoes at a typical store of, like, you know, 100 selections. And so there's a curatorial sense where person A can go in and pick a shoe and he looks like, you know, a dad. And then person B comes out of the store, you know, same store, but he's like the coolest guy on earth. So there's this sort of like anybody can win at this, first of all. Second of all is what you're saying about the sort of duality of shoes, which is it's designed to be worn on your feet and hence pretty destroyed. You know, it's like it's meant to protect your feet. So by using them, you're destroying the thing. But if you don't use it and you just put it on a shelf, you're not using the thing for its intended purpose. And if you think about anything else like that's collectible, you know, like art or, you know, watches or something, they don't deteriorate like a shoe would if you put it on your body. So there's kind of like this, if there's someone that's got a mint pair of Air Jordans or something, you know, there is some extreme care and some deliberateness where, like, this person said, I'm going to buy this shoe and not use it for its intended purpose. I'm going to put it on a shelf. So there's this kind of like maniacalness about it that's also very, very interesting, I think.
That was New York designer Jeff Staple in conversation with me and Andrew, and you're tuned in to the best of the Monocle Weekly. Our next chat is one that draws together some of our favourite things, talent, craft and big thinking, wrapped up in an even bolder sense of humour.
I thought you were describing yourself there, Rob. Now, Miriam Elliott is an artist and comedy writer who last year found herself at the centre of something of a viral literary hit with We Go to the Gallery, a sharply observed, beautifully illustrated and pretty hilarious satire on modern art establishments. It was written in the style of the classic hardback Ladybird children's books of the 1960s.
The project's original small run of 5,000 copies had just been extended when Miriam dropped by the Monocle 24 studios, and she joined Tom Edwards and Andrew back in October to talk all about it.
Well, last year, obviously, when the book came out, it was quickly banned, and I was sort of subjected to a lawsuit in some way. Yes.
So Ladybird Books weren't very keen that you had a ladybird on the cover, and you had kind of stolen their characters' names, they said.
And they sent me pages and pages of threatening letters saying, take this exhibition down. Destroy these books, in so many words. After a year of kind of rethinking how I could get round all of that, I managed to change the logo on the front, which is, well, the original was a Harlequin ladybird, which is a kind of foreign, violent ladybird. And now it's been changed to a dung beetle, which I thought worked really well as a concept. And I registered dung beetle as a corporation. So there is a Dung Beetle Limited.
So you've
and we're hoping in the success of this book to build like a huge office, which is a giant ball of dung.
I think I've worked at a couple of places like that before, and it is quite funny. Andrew and I were sort of laughing at this just before we started speaking to you. You know, there's this sort of corporate spiel of the Dung Beetle trademark, which is all done with real style.
Thank you.
And it is really funny. I was kind of joking, saying something, you know, you sometimes speak to sort of authors and you say, oh yes, this was a ribald story and very funny, but it is absolutely hilarious. Is that ultimately what's at the heart of this? It's great satire. It's just really funny.
Yes, it's very funny. I mean, there's obviously lots of other things within it that a good artist doesn't explain their work. So I'm not going to. But this book is now like affordable and out to the mass market, which is it wasn't actually what I intended it to be. Originally, it was just an artwork. I wasn't really thinking of doing this, but it's kind of taken on a life of its own, and I really enjoy the whole sort of printing, distributing, working with shops, so it's great.
Now, the setup for the book is that there's a mother who kind of loves art and feels that she understands art, and then her son and daughter who are a bit perplexed by everything she drags them around to see. Yeah. Is that something you had kind of spotted in galleries, like kids being hauled around by their...
That was my own childhood, yeah. Like, both my parents were artists and they met at the Royal College of Art, so I was kind of born into that world of big white spaces with stuff going on. And every Saturday or every Sunday as a child, as far back as I can remember, we'd have to go to a gallery. But the funny thing was, my father was very like pro-conceptual art. I think it's because he came from a design background. My mother was really figurative, life drawing, quite traditional. And she said that conceptual art was a joke.
That must have been some spicy discussions between the two of them.
There was some spicy... They're very different characters. They get on extremely well, but...
Did they laugh at your book?
Yeah, they both were really pissing themselves. My grandfather was a satirist and my uncle a punk, so there's a kind of strong sense of humour in the family. This was a response to my whole childhood, being dragged around galleries with my brother.
And the actual making of this book, you actually found kids up in Yorkshire, and you got these aren't just illustrations. You shot them.
I wanted it to be as true as possible to the Ladybird staff. So I researched the original illustrator, and he did this really rare interview just before he died. I think he died aged 95 or 96, and he finally revealed his technique, and it was to photograph, create collage, and then paint over the collage, which is what I thought they were. So, and he had gone to the north of England, so I put out a casting call in London looking for some kids to sort of dress up in that style, and nothing was, you know, it just didn't work. So I decided to look in the north, and I found these I found Peter and Jane, or John and Susan, whatever you want to call them. And they came down to my studio in London, and that was it.
Now, jokes don't really, the jokes in a way have to be seen with the pictures, but we should just give like a hint of one. So there's one where John is looking at a kind of Kuhnsian piece.
Jeff
Koons. He says, which one, the balloon ones. It says, "I want to play with the balloon," says John. "Only venture capitalists can play with this balloon," says Mummy.
Mummy is a nihilist, yeah.
Yeah, Mummy's the punk. And I love the way she kind of drags around her kids to kind of see like naked people and piles of rubbish and things. Have you sent any of these to the artists?
No, actually, I haven't. I didn't want it to be too personal about... I didn't use any artists' names because I thought it was about the concepts. But there's one artist, Martin Creed, who I knew some years ago that's referenced in there. But other than that, no, I haven't. I mean, maybe I should.
Is he the stinking rubbish?
Yeah, he's a stinking...
As
it were, Andrew.
As the featured artwork.
I mean, that does strike me as interesting, though. As you say, you know, it's sort of... lancing a lot of the pretension and stuff that some people associate with the sort of the world of art. Mm. Do you worry that as it, particularly because it's if it is indeed becomes even more successful, that in itself could cause, you know, resentment, and people say, oh, well, you know, look what you're doing. You're sort of, you know, cocking a snook at the art world. You were part of it. Do you worry that people might say, now you're turning yourself into an outsider?
Inevitably, anything that anyone does ever, somebody hates. I learned that very early on. So whatever you make, it doesn't matter. Someone's going to think it's not funny or silly or stupid or that you're this or that. It doesn't... Why bother making anything if that's the case? I just wanted to get a little bit closer to, you know, the truth.
And you say you've done the whole thing yourself. So you've found a publisher,
No, I am the publisher.
You are the publisher.
Yeah, I do everything myself. Like, I have help now, obviously, because you can't undertake such a big thing without help, but... I'm not really that interested in, you know, working with big publishers, because I have worked with publishers before and they're very nice people, but they take 90% of your profit.
That was Miriam Elliott talking to Tom Edwards and me a couple of months ago. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brûlé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
We're nearly at the end of our brief trip through some of the best bits of the Monocle Weekly in 2015, but there's just time to hear from US author Garth Risk-Hallberg, whose debut novel, City on Fire, set amid the mean underbelly of 1970s New York, caused a stir in the publishing world this year.
But it wasn't just a captivating storyline that caught readers' attention. A bidding war between rival publishers for Garth's original manuscript became something of a story in itself. He sat down with Rob to provide the backstory of a literary hit.
The novella was actually written in the space between having the initial vision for this book and working up the courage to actually do it. So I had had this vision in the summer of 2003, which was very inflected by, you know, the 18 months running up to the summer of 2003, which, you know, started in the fall of 2001. Mm. And, you know, we all remember that fall, I think. I'd had this vision in 2003 that was very sudden and felt like something that I wasn't in charge of. Something else was in charge and was saying, this is a book, or possibly this is the book. You are going to write it. And what it was a kind of vision of New York in the mid-70s, which was a time and a place that I'd spent a lot of time unpurposefully daydreaming about when I was a kid driving around the countryside where I lived, smoking cigarettes and listening to Patti Smith and feeling like she was the only person who got it, that time and that place was somehow going to be the setting through which all of the tensions and questions and baffling, bottomless mysteries that I and everyone I knew had been living through in 2001, late 2001, 2002, and 2003, were going to express themselves through.
So you're not necessarily searching for roots of that post-2001 problem explicitly, but there's some kind of churning of guts there.
I felt it almost as like a reflection or a, you know, some combination of a mirror and a magnifying glass, that all of these tensions between order on one hand and possibility on the other, and safety on one hand and freedom of the other, on the other, that had come up both interpersonally and civically and globally after September 2001, also existed in this very visible, heightened, vivid, exaggerated almost state in this other kind of inflection point in the life of the city, which was 1975, 1976, 1977. These were two sort of somehow weirdly parallel time periods, and that all of the sort of emotional, mental content of the time period I'd actually lived through was going to somehow come out by looking at this other seemingly distant time period. And of course, that sounds very insane and capricious to say, but that's like qualification number one for a novelist, is that you'd be sort of insane and capricious. Like, you know, if the novel worked, it would somehow persuade that that time had something important to tell us now. I didn't want it to be a purely historical novel, and I didn't want it to be just a work of nostalgia or something. I really thought of it as like a contemporary novel that happens to be looking for the contemporary in this specific time period. But after that sort of hot flash of vision, which I also saw, I was like, oh wow, it's like Bleak House. Like, it's,
yeah, Well, some one reviewer in here in the UK said it's like they've sort of morphed Middlemarch into 70s New York.
Oh, that's so good.
That's all right. That's all right. You'll take that one.
Send that person a gift basket. Because Middlemarch is like, Middlemarch is it. Because yeah. I wanted the social cutaway, right? Like you get this sort of anatomy of a world, which is beautiful. I'm not saying, you know, the book is beautiful, just that the idea that a piece of art can do that is beautiful. But and then Middlemarch, you get this like incredible depth of character. And the former thing, the sort of anatomy of the world, was something that I had started to see being done on television and that I felt in this kind of like mock competitive novelist mojo way of like, hey, you know, that's so cool, but you can't have that. Like,
TV's where it's at. I can have
it. It was like, we're
going to
take that back. Like, you learned that from us. But the other thing that George Eliot does in Middlemarch, you know, that you just absolutely live inside these people, is something that I have always felt that only a novel can do. And that's what I remember from novels. Like, I walk away from them and like 6 months later, the plot is productively lost to me. Yeah. So I can reread it again and be surprised. But the characters live with me. Yeah. But that, the idea that a 24-year-old nobody hick whose only qualification to write about the city was the immense love that I'd always had for it was going to even have the hubris to like try to do something like that just scared the bejesus of me. Out of me. So I put it in a drawer and I walked away and I thought I was going to come back to it for 10 years. You know, I thought it was like maybe in 10 years I'll have the chops to write this. And during that time when it sat in the drawer, I wrote short stories and I wrote the novella. But I also learned somehow that the fear I had felt about it in 2003 was actually, that's the signal. When you're trying to be an artist, the fear is the sign that you're onto the thing you should be doing.
In terms of the novel starts with a quote from television, the 70s New York band, that's nice and refreshing. Was the language of rock and roll music, that type of music as well, that kind of spiky kind of stuff, it's kind of got the same staccato rhythm with which a New Yorker speaks perhaps. Did that inflect the way you wrote as well? You mentioned Patti Smith. There's street smarts in the language there, but it also kind of get you into the vibe to listen to these records, to get you into the heads of the characters and the language that they speak.
I should just say, like, that album, that television album, what an album.
Yeah.
I mean, it just Lucky is Moon. Mind-blowingly yeah. good. But part of what I think I've always been chasing in prose, and it's probably unattainable in prose, is a sort of visceral rush of feeling that good rock music gives you. And I mean, prose can do a lot of things compensatorily that good rock music probably can't, but the feeling, you know, and the way that the feeling gets recalled again and again and again with no diminishment, if anything with an enhancement, you know, by a great rock song was something that I always sort of dreamed of doing in prose, and I still dream of someday doing it in prose, but some of the kind of liberties that I'm taking with the language, you know, which the which alluded to in conversation about the translators, have to do with trying to break some rules to get that feeling.
That was Garth Risk Hallberg talking to Rob about his debut novel, City on Fire, which is out now. It's Christmas, exactly the time to eat, drink and be merry and maybe enjoy a sing-song too. So let's end things on a musical note. London synth duo Erasure have given the world such behemoth pop hits as A Little Respect, Sometimes and Stop. And in 2015, the band, made up of singer Andy Bell and instrumentalist Vince Clark, celebrated 30 years of making music with always the very best of Erasure.
Andy dropped by the Monocle Weekly in November to discuss the band's career, and Andrew and I were more than happy to provide him with a little respect in return.
I mean, from the very beginning, I was a huge Vince Clark fan anyway, and I did think it was kismet when we met, and I thought, you know, I should write him a letter, see if he needs a new singer, and the ad I answered was for him. So in the first place, I was kind of, we were in the studio for 6 months doing the first album, which didn't take off in England anyway, and we had And I was just kind of in the studio staring at him because I couldn't believe there was this man that I really admired, you know. So I was very, very shy. It took ages. It took a while for my confidence to build up because, again, I used to rehearse along to Alison Moyet's voice, and people used to get us mixed up in the beginning, you know, until I kind of found my voice. But, I mean, Vince stuck by me because I was first employed as a singer, and he could have said, right, no, that's it, I'm going to move on. But he literally started from scratch with me, and we went round universities and clubs and kind of started building up a fan base. And then our first proper co-write was Sometimes, the song from the Circus album. And we would luckily, you know, it was played on the radio. And I think because we've been with Mute Records the whole time, even though they've been sold a few times and moved around, our catalogue's been spread out and then come back together again, I don't think we would still be here if we hadn't been with Mute the whole time, because Daniel Miller is a real fan of the music and the musicians, and he's always there behind the production of the album, each album, and he thinks touring is really important. So we've toured most albums apart from two, I think.
And tell me, the other, you know, you're an artist that appeals to all sorts of people, but you had a real commitment and a real voice and a real moment in gay clubs as well.
Yeah.
If you went to a gay club, your songs would always be there at a certain point of time. Did that feed into the music, or was that just an audience that kind of got, as Rob said, that slightly upturned tempo at the time?
Right. Well, I think definitely purposely on the very first album, I think maybe one of the reasons it hadn't worked was because I purposely pushed Vince in a direction that I don't know whether he wanted to go in, which was the tail end of high energy music, which was kind of like a genre in gay clubs in the late 70s, early 80s. And so that we kind of missed that, you know. I missed that music as well. But I think from being out from the very beginning, you know, I was inspired by Jimmy Somerville from Bronxky Beat. And he's, you know, he had the song Small Town Boy, which gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. So, and of course, Holly Johnson. And I just thought, well, at that time, it seemed to be some kind of gay movement, a wave going on in pop. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to do it and just say, make it normal, talking about your boyfriend and your partner and all that kind of stuff. And definitely the band became embraced, you know, so we were like selling out in San Francisco, and I got the keys to the city, and you kind of, you know,
how big are the keys to San Francisco?
I can't remember, because it was actually on a plaque. And I've lost the plaque somewhere. So somebody's
Andy
probably
Bell,
got the plaque.
Let me in.
I know. I've been going on to the San Francisco Council website to see where it's, you know, if there's a list where I can get a copy made or something. Yeah. But anyway.
Maybe you left them in the back of a cab or something.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're going around and touring, and especially like in the late 80s, early 90s, and going to gay clubs in New York and stuff when it was a bit more sleazy, it was so amazing. Especially like hearing your own music in there.
Is that a responsibility? Does it become something from you go, wow, I'm lifted up by this, and it breaks out of any sort of scene it might have been. But do you have a responsibility somehow as a spokesman? Was that in the early days?
You kind of do, yeah. I mean, you young people don't know who I am at all. They don't have a clue now, gay young people. And I don't expect them to either. You know, and you kind of, I feel a bit sometimes, it makes me feel like a historical character, you know, that's been forgotten slightly. But yeah, you know, we do lots of gay prides all the time. And, you know, I've honoured to be an ambassador for Harvey Milk School in New York, and patron for Diverse, which is an HIV charity in Cambridge, and stuff for the THT and National AIDS Trust. So you kind of do, I'm not that great of a public speaker, but every now and then it's nice just to go and, you know, rally people round.
I suppose you do it, and doing it with a lightness of, you know, doing it with a lightness of touch is the trick.
Yeah.
And tell me, the remastered versions of some of the songs, you say you feel you don't connect with the youngest audience out there now, but that is surely a chance for those songs to go off on a kind of another round around the clubs and things, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you do. I mean, there's quite a lot of young people that do follow us on Twitter, and I kind of think, I'm not sure how they've joined the dots up, you know, whether it's, because I don't think there are that many that have become children of the adults that heard our music. But I think so I think they kind of maybe like modern electronic music, and they've kind of like looked at the history of the music or something.
You're setting yourself short there. It's
well, I don't know.
DNA, the DNA of fantastic electronic music. It's Mute Records. It's all that. It's wonderful, you know. Yeah.
And tell me, it was a tricky thing for a band that had very big hits, you know, that you know when you do a show, they are needed.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with a song like A Little Respect?
Well, A Little Respect is great because it sings itself, that song. It's amazing, you know, it's such an anthem.
Not with our voices, it doesn't.
we'll join in on the chorus.
You know, and sometimes, I mean, you fall in and out of love with songs, you know, I mean, Au L'Amour kind of, you know, that got boring sometimes, but then I just love the intro. But it is quite tricky picking the ones to sing each time from the catalogue, but obviously you want to put, like, lesser-known songs in there, and then when you're promoting an album, you want them to hear the new stuff, so it is quite tricky putting them all together, but I quite love it because I always feel like, you know, you're creating a playlist and being master of your own show kind of thing by doing that, you know, so...
And I love Mute Records, and I love your records, but not a lot of Mute artists have greatest hits in the sense that you do. So it's kind of an exciting thing for Mute and for Daniel Miller as well.
Well, Mute's very cool. I mean, Daniel's amazing as well, and he's, you know, he comes to the shows, and he's a bit of an enigma, but it's great when he comes. He's very sincere about what he does. You know.
And that's nearly all for the Monocle Weekly in 2015. Pretty good year, hey, Rob?
A classic year. If you had to pick one hit from the hits, who would it be?
Oh, God,
Spaceman?
Spaceman was good. Andy Bell from Erasure.
I was going to say,
I loved Andy Bell.
I loved Andy Bell. I felt slightly starstruck by Andy Bell when he came in. And it's always nice when your heroes don't let you down.
And I think it's also nice that we've just met so many great people over the past year. So if you're kind of stuck for something to do today, go back to the archive because there's so many good things. People should go back and listen to the big interviews as well. Oh, we've just had a very good year at Monocle 24. And it's been nice to spend it with you, Rob, in this room.
It's been pretty good, hasn't it? It's been us two together in this studio.
Yes.
And if not, I'm sure for very good reasons.
Good.
So we should thank all our wonderful guests, the people that appeared in the show and every single guest booked all year. And we should thank our team behind the glass. Today's show and nearly all the others this year have been produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager, as ever, has been Claire Urban. We'll be back next week to kick off the new year with the first episode of 2016. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound.
And I've been Andrew Tuck.
Thank you very much for tuning in.